This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi, Stacey Cole, and Todd Michaels.
We're talking with Siobhan Scott about the Charlie Kirk assassination. What happens next? What's going on? What was going on in the mind of his assassin? And where, you know, where we're at in our country, where things are going, where we're at, and you know, the threats, the reality, the uncomfortable atmospheres that all of us live in, no matter, you know, who you are, where you are, if you have kids in school, if you don't, there's so many questions swirling around our safety right now. And the see something, say something, but do something seems to be the missing part. That's what we're digging into today. I want to ask you this, Siobhan, and I have a story I'll add to it. How much problem is there with burnout amongst educators, amongst authorities, amongst counselors within their schools, amongst, okay, we see something, we say something, and now, you know, we're going to notify who we're supposed to notify, but nothing happens. And then eventually they're just like, well, why do I keep calling the police? Why do I keep calling the FBI? And I'm saying this because I actually had this very conversation yesterday. I got a call from a school, my child's school, about some information that she learned about another human being that was not good information, and she reported it. And I won't go into what the details were, but the school called me and said, hey, you know, and now she's really anxious about what she reported because she doesn't want the repercussions from the kids of, you know, I was the one that reported this. We talked about that a bit. And then when I talked to the school, here's what I got. And I like the school. I'm not trying to rip on the school. I'm not going to say the school, but I said, okay, so I'm just curious now that you have this information, what do you do with it? And I know you can't tell me details of, you know, anybody's family or parents, but like, how do you what is the process that you go through? Cause I wanted to challenge it to see what it was.
That's good.
And the response I got was, well, we let the parents know.
Oh.
And then I said, okay. And
that's a wild card.
And I said, so are you're relying on those parents of these kids that are already making these horrible decisions. And again, look, you can be a great parent and your kid can make horrible decisions. I'm not saying that. But we just got to consider the source of where these things are coming from. And you're relying on them to then make the right choice or like to do what is needed to tamper this down and stop this. Well, we can't judge. We can't judge the parents. I said, you can and you can't. I know what you're saying. I know legally you can't judge, blah, 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 blah. But I said, okay, answer me this. You're a mandatory reporter, right? Yes. I said, okay, I work in true crime every day. And here's what I see a lot. Mandatory seems to be the option.
Yes.
And people seem to be going down this world, and there seems to be so many mandatory reporters that feel it's a lot more optional than it is mandatory. I said, so what does mandatory reporting mean? Mm-hmm. Well, that we have to report it to the FBI or to the police. I'm like, okay, so what was missing from that process we just talked about there?
Yeah, then what, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, normally, then I got the excuse. Then I got the, well, you know, when we call, you know, some, you know, nothing happens. I said, but it's on a record. I said, that's the part you're missing. It's going to at least be on record. So then the next time this happens, which it will, there's something else to go off of. And it's not just, well, we told the parents and the parents didn't do anything. Because surprise, surprise, a high percentage of these folks and the parents don't give a shit about their kids very much. That's why their kids are doing what they're doing. So then to rely on the very source that brought them into the world to be responsible, to not let little Jimmy go off the rails, who's already way the fuck off the rails, to suddenly pull them back in, that's insane. That judge away. Judge the shit out of that, because it's not going to fix the problem. They're not going to fix the problem. But my point is the burnout, and I felt bad for this, and I wasn't trying to be an asshole. I kind of was. But I wasn't trying to, but I was just kind of like, This is the problem. Right. This is where we're assuming it's going to be solved over here, and we can take it off our plate. I can check the box that says I did this when you really didn't do shit.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that now that I'm going to step off my little box of ivory soap.
Yeah, I see so much educator burnout, and it's a very hard time to be a teacher because they are expected to basically reparent a lot of kids who are not being well parented at home, don't have social skills, are aggressive and act out and can't control themselves directly because of inadequate parenting at home. So that's a huge problem. And then even if it is reported to law enforcement, more cases in my book where that ball was dropped, you know, I mean, terrible cases where the ball was dropped. And again, it's not always dropped. And I think a lot of cases are interrupted, but it often is. And so we need that team intervention where a kid is flagged. Immediately, the team meets with mental health, someone from law enforcement, and someone from the school, and they develop a plan. Okay, what are we going to do here? How do we follow up? How are we going to monitor? Mm-hmm. But I think also of the parents of the Michigan high school shooter a couple years ago, where they were encouraging him. Mm-hmm. And this was a really disturbed kid. Mm-hmm. And they bought him the AR-15 and supplied the bullets. And he was posting really threatening kinds of things on Facebook with his gun. And, you know, they ended up convicted because of that. And so, the sad, ugly truth is that's another factor. And I think all the mass shootings is in some cases, you know, parents weren't doing anything wrong. There were other factors, you know, largely the internet influences that the kids had gotten into. But sometimes you're right. You've got inadequate parents. So calling the parents and saying, oh, guess what he said today? Well, maybe that's the way dad talks around the dinner table at home, you know, about who he wants to kill. And it's hard.
And people don't like being accused of being inadequate, especially as a parent. And they don't like being, you know, pointed out what's wrong. And sorry, that's the reality in some of these situations. And I get the burnout. I mean, how many times can you do the same action over and over with no real meaningful resolution? And then you get, you know, me who's like, why aren't you doing this? Yeah. And I get why. But then it just ends in a stalemate because eventually she was like, I'm going to call the FBI. Thank you. I'm going to hold you accountable for this. Please do what you're supposed to do. Yeah. You know, I appreciate that. That this needs to be known. But when you have it over and over, you know, you get to that point of feeling, you know, it's like a level of hopelessness.
It does become a hopelessness and overwhelming. And I have to say, I see so many teachers leaving the profession. Yeah. Mm-hmm. People that went into it because they love kids, they care deeply. I think they do wonderful work. But the social problems that they are running into, and they do their best, but they can't. Yeah. They can't fix it. And it's just eating them up.
No, we shouldn't be relying on teachers to be parents when we're also tying their hands to any sort of parental or any sort of directional skills that they should be giving children, but they can't because, well, you don't want to hurt their feelings too, because the second that happens, then it's the teacher's fault. And then they just give up. They're like, I'm going to check the boxes. I'm going to do this until I'm going to collect my pension and get the hell out of Dodge. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be the attitude of so many teachers right now. And I see it firsthand. I'm friends. I'm very close with many and that are my age that got into the profession and now they're only in their 40s. They're not going to retire. They're not going to be, the 60-year-old teacher someday that's like, I did my whole, you know, life and this is great. They're like, I'm out.
Yeah, they're going to now. Starbucks. It's just easier.
I can't deal with this for my own well-being. I mean, is this, I mean, and again, and you look, well, what's the problem with that? Well, the system, the system's not enabling any sort of real meaningful change or help that needs to go on with some of these kids and allow the educators to do their job and to help. And the resources are simply not there. So then we have that issue that we go into. It's a circle of fear. The schools don't want to admit there's a problem. They don't want any sort of negative publicity. We don't want to make anybody feel uncomfortable. We don't want to, you know, it's always fear. It's some reason why we're not doing what we're supposed to be doing. And if you go to the next person on the scale, that's the reason. And it just keeps going. Mm-hmm. It's a culture of fear that we're living in for various reasons as to why systemically it all fails then.
Mm-hmm. Very much so. Very much so. And it also makes me wonder, at one point I looked up the data on how many calls does the FBI get in a day about potential threats. And it was overwhelming.
Yeah.
And so how effective can the, you've got some FBI folks on the show. I mean, that would be interesting to talk to them. What is staffing in the FBI like at this point? And how able are they to follow up when, you know, there's a threat about a high school somewhere?
Have to have the head of the FBI taking it upon himself to fly specific things to places personally so he can take credit and put his name in front of everything, you got problems. Mm-hmm, it gets a little inefficient when you start doing or not doing your job, you know, effectively. The act at here, it wasn't a private confrontation, obviously. It was, you know, a long-range shot during a large public event. What does that kind of setting suggest psychologically about what this was about? That it was a very public thing, that this wasn't something where someone plotted to do it, you know, where there wasn't a large crowd. Does the crowd play into this, and does that play into the minds of people like this, where they want to do it in some sort of a spectacle sort of way?
Sometimes it does. I'm not sure in this case. It may just have been this is an easy opportunity because there's an open space, there's a roof. I will have a good angle for shooting, and that could have been as complicated as it got. Was he trying to make a statement to freak a bunch of people out? That's possible, but I didn't get the sense from anything we know thus far that he had any intention to hurt anyone else other than to just eliminate who he saw as his enemy.
Well, the strange part of this is this could have gone so terribly wrong. It did go terribly wrong, and don't get me wrong there. Obviously, a life was lost, but there were thousands of college students
there.
Could have been
worse.
Yes. Yeah, it could have been horrific.
Yeah.
This could have been a mass shooting. So
could have, but that wasn't his intent. His intent was not to make it a mass shooting.
No, but what if he missed? What if he was nervous? Mm-hmm. What if he picked off three or four people in front and then kept going? Mm-hmm. There were just so many variables here. Mm-hmm. So, you know, was this something that he was practicing for, or was he just that good a shot and decided I need to do this?
He was an avid video game player, first-person shooter, and I'm not saying video games cause people to do things like this, but they get good. You get good.
But there's such a difference. You know, I've talked about how I've gone to the shooting range many times, and there's such a marked difference between holding that gun in your hand and feeling that kickback versus I'm just playing a video game. He was really a great shot. So to me, I want to know.
Well, his family, they practice.
He learned how to do it.
I mean, and then if you're every day sitting there simulating murder simulation on your video games, you know, you end up losing that the normalcy becomes what it is, becomes normal.
Yeah, and that's just it. It feels very different to all of a sudden. You're pointing at a human being versus a screen.
But it's not a human anymore.
Right. And you know what? When I've worked with soldiers who came home from Afghanistan, I said, how did you do this? Because they were very nice people. They were not psychopathic. They were sensitive guys. And they had their own post-war trauma. But I said, what was it like for you to be a sniper and to be taking a human life? And they said, I pretended I was playing a video game. because I was a gamer. And that's where I just went. I had to hit the target, hit the target, hit the target. And so they were able to dissociate, I think, from the fact it's a target and they're not up close. It's not like they're stabbing someone, you know, it's just, same thing with the people who use drones. Mm-hmm. It's very much like a video game. I've talked to them because they will assassinate, you know, mm-hmm. at remote distances with a drone. And yeah. So it's that desensitization process that they go through.
And it looks just like a video game on a drone.
Yeah, it does. Know? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's identical. I mean, and if you can get into that mindset and then you get so desensitized to reality. The term that gets thrown around on this one and really in all master, oh, he snapped. You must have went crazy. Obviously, it goes far deeper than that to get in front of any of this. And we've talked about all sorts of lovely ways that, you know, if enacted, you know, would save lives without a doubt. Mm-hmm. Is our society remotely intelligent enough or smart enough to actually do any of these things? And if they're not to the level of to which we described, how the hell do we get there? What on a simplistic level? I mean, because at the end of the day, the mindset of most people is basically operating 8-year-olds in adult bodies. How do we communicate this to the people that need to have this communicated of what to look out for, how to get into a better place? Siobhan, solve the world's problems right now.
I know.
Right now, huh? You've got 4 minutes. Go for
it. That's why I write these books, right? It's like I get really, my books are the result of me being frustrated.
Sure.
And if something is bugging me and I'm writing about it over and over and trying to educate people, it's like, okay, let's just put a book out here and see if anybody will read it. But of course, the people who need to read these kind of books aren't reading.
Right? No. No,
they're not. They're out at the shooting galleries.
Yeah, they're playing Call of Duty.
Yeah, exactly. So it's my frustration. I acknowledge some burnout over it. We keep talking about it just like you like to do. We keep pushing prevention. We keep pushing the need for mental health people in school that can catch the third grader writing stories about murder. We want to keep plugging away at it, but it does feel like, bailing the ocean with a teaspoon sometimes. And the more and more time kids are disengaged from real world and social relationships and productive activities, the more time they spend online going to very dark, unhealthy places. It's a concern. I think that's why we're seeing so many more mental health problems in kids, because they're not spending time in productive activities, real life activities. They're off in the virtual world and they're not in good places, many of them.
Go ahead, Stacey.
What is the difference between a budding serial killer or a budding mass shooter and maybe an up-and-coming Stephen King in third grade with a vivid imagination?
One shops at Borders, one shops at Walmart, one shops at Target. There's your difference.
It just popped up, in my brain. Like, I've known some of these dark individuals who wear all black and they wear capes and they write
me on Halloween and other times.
Yeah, Siobhan.
But what is the difference between just this creative soul that you don't want to crush, in third grade, but they're dark?
I think there's a difference. It may be subtle sometimes between kids, let's say the goth lifestyle. My daughter, right, is into the goth lifestyle. But that's different than writing a story as a young child about cutting your mother's head off. You know what I mean? It's the degree of violence. And I've often said, I would be kind of, I think he's mellowed out in his old age, but I would have always felt a bit uneasy living next door to Stephen King or having him over for dinner. I mean, what's all the, because some of his stuff, especially the early stuff, was really, really horror. I mean, he writes horror, right? But really horrifying. And I would somebody would recommend a book and I would read the book and I'd go, oh my God, I'm traumatized after, you know, I'd have to flip pages ahead. Yeah. So it's maybe a subtle difference, but I think kids who are showing those fascinations really young, it's worth taking a look at. And, sure. And I particularly in the 90s with the whole alternative goth movement and all the music and, you know, people were really worried. I had those kids come into therapy, but it was pretty easy to tell that most of them, it was just benign. You know, yeah. It really wasn't something that they were focused on, fixated. Often they love their animals and, you know, they were kind. They weren't out killing the puppies. I mean, you know, you can suss that out.
Sure.
Back when Marilyn Manson was the worst of our problems.
I know.
Remember those days? Remember that?
Kiss. Wow. Yeah.
I want to say, I mean, this is just kind of an observation I've made as someone, you know, I was born in the 80s. I grew up, you know, I was born in 82. So I grew up in the 90s and I was in the world of, you know, the most violent game was Mortal Kombat. And yes. that was the big one.
That, you know, was a big controversy.
Back then, big controversy.
I found out my son was playing it and I had a talk with him about it. And then it turned out he was the champion of the county at Mortal Kombat at one of the big arcades he would go to. And I went in there and I saw his name on a plaque at the wall, yeah. Matt, the champion of Mortal
nice.
Kombat. I had a little meltdown about it. You know, well, we had to talk about it. Yeah.
Outside the studio, I have all of the actual arcade machines. So I still enjoy the game. Yeah. But it's, you know, that was the big thing. And then we got into the world where things got a little more crazy. The Grand Theft Autos of the world came out. I was like 18, 19 when Grand Theft Auto 3 came out. That was the first one that was real. It was the open world and you can walk around and you're just shooting up things. And there's missions and all that, but it was kind of like, it was shocking. And I remember playing it at that age, you know, and the shock value was, oh my God, this is crazy. Thank God we don't live in a world like this. 25 years later, we live in a world like that.
We do.
Literally like Grand Theft Auto. The video game has become far closer to reality than a satire of reality. And I think it's it's a very interesting game. And I'm not like anti, and I don't play many games anymore, but I don't know that the answer ever has been or ever will be, let's get rid of video games or anything like that. But what? And I always thought that was silly, you know, when those arguments were being made back then. But I mean, come on, this is, we're talking something very different than what Mortal Kombat or Street Fighter was versus what is being fed into these very young minds and what we understand of how our brains work and how we develop and how we desensitize all these things that we know far more about now than we did in 1993. Do we need to take a look at this a little bit? Because I know, well, we put the labels on that says 18 years or older, blah, 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 whatever. None of it does anything.
Eight-year-olds are playing this.
Exactly. Yeah. So, but do we need a little bit of a reckoning here? Do we need to say, like, this is not okay. This is not healthy. We can't keep feeding our kids this shit and just letting them run rampant with it and then go, well, kids will be kids. I can't stop them. You're the adult.
Yeah.
Yes, you can stop them. You're the adult.
You're the adult.
Try being one. But then the adult's like, I like playing it too. And I can say, I'm guilty of this shit. Right. I've played Grand Theft Auto with my daughter. Yeah. And she's like, holy shit, this is crazy. And I don't worry that she's going to go do any of that. Right. But that there's a difference there. There's some, I don't know. Like, I don't know how you could police it, can police it, should police it. I don't know. But there is a huge difference in the world since Grand Theft Auto and then the world of Call of Duties and everything else have come into complete mainstream life and acceptance where you have kids playing it and then their 40-year-old dad is doing it as well. We're in a very different place since we've started murder simulating in our living rooms on a daily basis.
And that's the perfect way to put it. It's murder simulation, one of the most horrifying games, because I did a book on video game addiction and I used to do a lot of game research, including playing them with my sons.
Yeah.
And the most horrifying one I saw was created in Japan, and it was a very graphic game where the goal was to rape.
Jesus.
And explicit and very sexualized.
We thought our games were bad here.
And, well, you could get it here.
Oh, God.
Yeah, yeah. And probably still can, so I won't name the game. But yeah, you consider 8-year-old, 9-year-olds, 10-year-olds playing rape simulations, not to mention murder simulations. And so when we look at turning down the heat in our culture politically, trying to find more common ground, get people to stop thinking with such extremist ideology, and giving our kids more pro-social positive activities, because it also has a lot to do with the amount of hours they're spending on games versus doing productive activities in the real world where they're making friends and you know, playing sports, doing scouts, you know, things that are healthier for them. Because a lot of these kids that have done mass shootings, they're playing violent games all the time.
Yeah.
And so it's not necessarily that they're you know, playing a violent game, but it's the amount of time they're playing. And some of them have used the games as rehearsals. So they play in a qualitatively different way.
If they were just going to harness this for good, can you imagine what they'd accomplish?
Well, if we can get into their worlds, and again, that requires parenting, that requires parents being parents, which ultimately is probably the answer to 99% of these problems of parents not being parents, is getting in there and showing these kids and their brains, you know, you're not going to have a conversation and go, you're going to like doing this better than playing the game. No, I'm not the game. I like it. It's getting into their heads and showing the reward of something other than the video game that's just feeding it right at that moment in time over and over and over, showing them a reward that makes them go, oh, this is a lot more enjoyable than sitting here and doing this.
Yeah.
But again, requires parenting.
Yeah, making life worth living in positive ways. I think we all need that. We have to feel productive. We have to find joy. We have to have healthy human relationships with real people in the real world and not just get lost.
Yeah. And it's hard. It's hard. I mean, look, I'm a parent. You're a parent. It's hard. I can say I'm guilty of a bunch of the things I'm criticizing.
But it's
a matter of really just stepping up. And unless parents start doing that and getting involved in their children's lives. And I know kids, mom, dad, you go over there or what, you know. It's your job. Mm-hmm. Start doing it, you know, and I can say that to myself too.
Me too. Think
it's something we all need to be aware of because nothing's going to change unless that starts happening. Mm-hmm. Siobhan Scott, psychotherapist, author of this book, The Minds of Mass Killers, and your memoir, which is also out right now, Nightbird, available wherever books are sold. Please go and check all of that out. Thank you so much. I dropped a bottle on the dog.
Excellent. Great.
It's an empty bottle of juice. We're good. please go and check that out. Until next time, for Siobhan, for Todd and Stacy, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Mr. Monopoly here. Monopoly is back at McDonald's. Register in the McDonald's app so you're ready to
get your bag.
Two ways to peel for a chance to
get your bag.
Physical peels with select items and digital peels with others to
get your bag.
Play Monopoly at McDonald's.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
No purchase necessary. See rules at playatmcd.com for full details and amoe.playatmcd.com to play without purchase. Ends November 23rd, but bonus play ends November 2nd. Monopoly is a registered trademark of Hasbro. Copyright McDonald's.